mic on. Well, welcome to day two of the 50th annual Mulch and Soil Council meeting. Today is really about program topics, so I'm looking forward to all of the content today. I'm also looking forward to your guys' engagement, questions, and let's make this a very beneficial session today. So before I start off, I do want to thank Vermeer for their welcome reception last night. That was well attended and much appreciated by all. I'm sure everyone enjoyed some drinks, food, as well as made some new contacts, hopefully. So thank you to Vermeer for that session last night. Just a little bit about how today's going to flow, just to remind you of what today is about. So the first session will be about the art of innovation. This will take us for about 45 minutes or so, maybe an hour. Questions are welcome, I believe, throughout or at the end, so feel free to jump in. We'll do our best to kind of make sure you're loud enough if you do have questions, or if you feel comfortable coming to the front, feel free to do that too. Next, we'll have a break that will actually be sponsored by Faltech Industries. After that, we will actually have our session on consumer needs, so hopefully you're looking forward to understanding gardening trends and consumer needs. That will be from 10:30 to 11:30. And then after that, we will head upstairs for our keynote luncheon. So I am well aware that right now, I believe there is only one elevator working. We will see if that gets addressed prior to all of us having to make our way all the way to the top of the elevator later this morning. If the elevators are working, hopefully they will be, you will push the button that says S, Duck Palace. And then we will find the room for our keynote speaker at where Erica Orange will be talking about reimagining the future. I will find out if stairs are an option, if that is something folks want to make sure they get their steps in today to be able to make it all the way to the top. But hopefully the elevators will be working. That is where lunch will be. If the session prior to that finishes early, feel free to please go ahead and head upstairs. Lunch will be set. How that will work is first we'll start eating. There should be salads and entrees, dessert. We'll allow everyone a little bit of time to eat before the keynote actually starts speaking, and that way there's not a lot of clanking and noise as she is presenting to us, and hopefully that will be a wonderful session as well. After that, we'll head back down to this same room where we'll have another session presented by LoadScan, and then another break sponsored by TH Glenn Company. Now, after that, we do have a change in our presentations for today. So, unfortunately, one of my peers, Ann Aquillo, was not able to attend due to some personal situations that came up at the last minute. Now, I know I was personally looking forward to this session. I'm sure all of you were as well, so I sincerely apologize for this. Ann has the presentation ready. We will figure out a way to ensure that you guys are able to see the presentation, whether it's with a live stream, a webinar, or some other format. So we will make sure that that content is shared with the industry, hopefully even able to ask some questions. But that is something you should see after this session is over. You'll get more details on how we plan to present that information to you to help you of what is really going on in DC. So you may be wondering, okay, what are you going to do with that time? Well, we have a plan. So I heard from several of you after the David Crow talk yesterday that there was no time for questions. Right? We're going to have that time now. So our last session before the president's reception today will be kind of a town hall presentation Q&A session with David Crow coming back up here. He will have additional content that will cover some of the same topics that Ann Aquila was planning to present from a different perspective. So if there are no questions, we'll make sure that we've got content to share. But feel free, if you had them, and I know some of you did, be prepared to ask those questions at that session at the end of the day today. After that, we will wrap up with our president's reception that is sponsored by Social Marks Media. And again, that will be in the Hernando de Soto bar around the corner where the reception was last night. Okay, well, I am excited about today. I hope you guys are as well. So let's go ahead and get started. So our first speaker here is Ted Dirks from Vermeer Corporation. After studying composting and graduating with a degree in environmental studies from Central College, he joined equipment manufacturer Vermeer Corporation in Pella, Iowa. For the past 10 years, he has been traveling about 25 weeks a year, roaming North America and helping organizations set up compost facilities, manufacture mulch, clear land, and produce biofuels. As he interacts with operations, he is a curious learner of all things that make their operations successful and strives to help operations improve by sharing best practices. He's presented at multiple conferences, even outside of here, U.S. Compost Council, Canada Compost Council, so has done a similar presentation in those formats, and we're very excited that he was able to kind of adjust that presentation to what makes sense to our industry group today. So what is this session? This session is about the art of innovation, lessons to help uncover your next big breakthrough. And really, the goal of this session this morning is to inspire you guys, the audience, the membership of Mulch and Soil Council, to think differently about how you can take ideas, evaluate them, and uncover your next big breakthrough. This is really about helping our industry, pushing things forward, and allowing us to grow as we all want to do. With that, please give a warm welcome to Ted Dirks.
All right. Good morning, everyone, and thank you to Kimberly and the Mulch and Soil Council for having me. I find it really ironic that they chose this topic as their lead-off to this morning. I developed this presentation a couple years ago, and much of the world has changed since then, right? And today, innovation is more important than ever as our society and our economies and our customers are trying to establish this new normal they talk about. And as we try to come out of this unprecedented crisis and this constraint on our supply chains, the opportunities for innovation, the forgiveness, the risk of failure is certainly a lot softer than it is in what you'd call normal times. And what was once a competitive edge for many of you in the pre-COVID era may no longer hold true today. So I know last night at the reception, I was talking to a few of you, and you're trying to find different ways to use your mulch or different markets to get rid of your wood waste. And so I think many of you will appreciate this morning's talk. And many times when we have crises, they are like electricity for innovation. And so as leaders, I implore you not to waste this time. If you're not asking questions of your customers and trying to seek clarity and understanding of how you can do better or adjust your products or better align with their needs, it's really a huge wasted opportunity. I think much of it starts with challenging the current orthodoxies. I'm sure whenever you've tried to institute a new product or a new process within your organization, you've heard the old adage, oh, that'll never work because this is the way we've always done things, right? And that is a very dangerous, complacent mindset to find yourself in. And so, and oftentimes these orthodoxies hold some truth, and those comments do hold some truth because at one time they were true. But as we all know, the world is ever-changing. And so as our businesses evolve, we need to be seeking and understanding opportunities to better align our products and our services with our customers. And far too often, these norms go unchecked and unchallenged. And the most innovative ideas have often been inspired by breaking with tradition. Much like Vermeer Corporation, I don't know how many of you know the history of our company, but we were founded in 1948 in the post-World War II era, when the country came out and the economy really started to flourish and became much more industrialized. And so what that led to was, in the heartland in Iowa where our company is founded, a real lack of farm labor. And young Gary Vermeer, working on his farm, was very frustrated with the back-breaking labor of emptying a wagon. And so the first invention that Vermeer Corporation was founded on was a simple wagon hoist, which was a combination of pulleys, and you would chock the tires and the tractor would pull forward and that wagon would dump the grain and save vast amounts of time. And then as the economy continued to develop, farm ground became more and more valuable, and as Gary seeks solutions to clear the land, a big challenge is the stumps that are left behind. And so back in the mid-1950s, guys were using dynamite, axe, fire, and it was incredibly time-consuming, obviously very dangerous. And so he knew there had to be a better way and invented this stump cutter. The irony of this stump cutter was that it was actually, during development, the real key to the success of the stump cutter was actually an accident. The test engineer working on it hit the wrong lever, and the wheel started to go sideways, and they discovered that it cut about 5 times faster, and that's still the way we cut stumps today. So we call those little happy accidents. And then as farm ground still continued to be more valuable, farmers were seeking solutions to make the ground more productive by tiling and trenching the ground to be able to make it more farmable. And so he developed a line of track trenchers to dig trenches and to be able to put in tile. And then this product line quickly was incorporated into a lot of utility installation, which is really the largest part of Vermeer's business today. And then many of you that grew up on farms know the backbreaking labor of putting up hay in small square bales. And back in the late 1960s, many farmers were very frustrated with the labor intensiveness of this chore. And Gary went to the shop and in a matter of about 6 weeks had a working prototype of the first round baler. Just seeking and understanding the farmer's need of needing a way to collect hay and bale it in a much larger form. This was the huge invention that really launched us throughout the 1970s on a big trajectory of success. And then as urban areas became more dense, trenching in utilities was not nearly as effective. And so we needed a means not to cut a trench because there's already, you know, sewer pipes and power lines in the ground. We invented the horizontal directional drill, which is basically like a large sewing needle that you can steer and carve up and around through utilities and be able to install utilities much more effectively. And then in the mid-1990s, as many of you were perhaps in the tree care business and many landfills and states were starting to ban wood waste from going into the landfills, we launched our first line of tub grinders, the TG400, which allowed you to further process the large stumps and root balls into recycled wood for mulches and different outlets. And in the 2000s, we challenged the mining industry with a surface mining excavation technology, where traditionally it's drilling and blasting, which is still used today and is very effective. But a surface miner can be much more precise and minimize a lot of the hazards around a mine. And today, we sell surface mining equipment all around the world, allowing to serve those customers much better. And then in the recent years, you may have seen, we, after 50 years of continued innovation in the round baler, we developed the first self-propelled, zero-turn hay baler on the market. And so it's through these 73 years of development and constantly seeking a better way of understanding how to do things that I want to share with you some of the principles and practices to help uncover big breakthroughs and to filter and align those ideas with your organization and to understand the risks and how to manage those risks through the project. This is an image of our campus in Pella, Iowa. We also manufacture in 3 other states and 2 other countries, and we're somewhere north of 150 unique models and products. So innovation is really the lifeblood of our company, and I'm really excited to share how we do it. But I first want to start with a simple definition. The word innovation gets thrown around a lot, and perhaps too much, and I want to share with you this morning what it means to us. And it's simply the process of discovering unmet customer needs and then developing solutions to address them, all right? And I want to highlight one key word and just point out a couple of different things here. That key word is customer, right? We all know the customer is always right. But the key word here, the two things to think about is, who are you a customer for? And how can you help them innovate? These are often your suppliers and your vendors. I know some of our best ideas come from our customers. So think about how you can help your suppliers and innovators better innovate, because it's their products that ultimately dictate how innovative you can be for your customers. And I think there's a lot of synergies and opportunities of working together there that can help your own operations get better. The other aspect of customer is, think about this on the micro. Innovation is not just reserved for new products or new services, but it can be for your processes within your organization. Each time a product goes throughout your value stream, it really goes from a seller to the next buyer, and there's a chain of customers throughout your operations, and there's incredible amounts of opportunity to innovate and to improve the efficiencies within your organization by applying and thinking about some of these same questions. We've been doing this at Vermeer for the better part of 25 years through our lean manufacturing journey, and today we continue that through our continuous improvement efforts. And it really allows you to do a lot more with less, which I think one thing we can all agree on is we're struggling for help and for labor in today's market. So think about how you can apply those things throughout your operation. But before I begin, I want to start with debunking a myth. I think many of you can recall some of the world's greatest innovators, guys like Thomas Edison, Henry Ford, Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, and the list can go on and on. And society leads us to believe that they accomplished all of that great success really by their own genius. And that is an absolute myth. What these great innovators realize early on is that they can't do it on their own. They need to tap into what we call the collective genius of their organization and surround themselves with really bright, talented individuals. And so my first principle I want to share with you is think about how you can empower and really establish a much stronger innovative culture. Do your employees, do your team members feel empowered to discuss new product ideas or product improvements? Is there debate going on within your organization to understand what these new ideas could mean? And do you give them the time to develop new ideas? There's so much potential within your organizations. And innovation is not reserved for management or ownership. It should be anyone from the truck driver all throughout the organization. Everyone that's got an idea for an improvement or a customer idea should feel empowered to share that, discuss it, and debate it. Another important aspect of that is recognition. And this is basically just telling your team members that this is something that my organization values, and they can take a lot of pride in investing the time and energy to thinking innovatively and trying to build innovative new products and to do that. At Vermeer, we have our Inventors Club that I'm not sure a sales manager will ever get the chance to participate in, but when mostly intellectual property is established, there is an annual dinner where our engineering teams are recognized for those really inventive ideas, and they get a really nice commemorative plaque signifying the patent or the intellectual property that was established. And it really gives a bit of prestige within our company to empower that kind of innovative spirit. Which leads me to my last point when it comes to establishing an innovative culture. I think it's really important to give it meaning, almost like a mantra for what your company believes in and what it stands for. This could be well aligned with your company's brand message, or it could be something, a philosophy that maybe the founder or a key manager within your organization carries. At Vermeer, our innovative spirit is really rooted in our founder, Gary Vermeer, who passed away at the age of 90 in 2009. But he had a really kind of ruthless, relentless spirit of constantly questioning how things are done and always saying there has to be a better way. And as you can see when you come visit our museum and you see our organizations, we are never done developing and innovating and asking questions of our customers of how we can do better. So think about how you can build that spirit of innovation within your organization. So once you establish that, you need to ready yourself for a wave of these, right? Once they feel empowered to share ideas, they come flooding in from all directions, some good, some bad. But this is a caution. I need to caution you. This is where a lot of companies start to drift in the wrong direction. While opinions are very interesting, they are often loosely formed opinions about our customers. And at the end of the day, they really, really don't matter. We often see this when companies have a lot of success. They develop a lot of expertise, and this is often in your product development teams, your engineers, and there's this shift that occurs where they forget that their company's success was actually founded on a very outside-in thinking, and they start to believe that their next big breakthrough is going to come from their own genius, their own expertise. And that is a huge fallacy. And that shift can be called going from outside in to more inside out thinking. And it's very dangerous. We often see this with some of the biggest corporations in America that have had decades of success really start to lose touch with what it is their customer needs are. And it's often rooted in these experts that think they know, and they develop these opinions of what they know. But the reality is, and my next principle I want to share with you, is that you really need to be obsessed with market information and core customer needs. And these are not loosely formed opinions. These are clear, obvious facts. You know, you can clearly see this customer is struggling with this problem. And then, you know, supporting it with market information that validates that that is a real problem, and it's a problem across all multiple customers. So what market information might look like is obviously maybe market share reports, sales reports, competitive profiles, really customer profiles, any kind of information you can gather. This is really the backbone to many of your decisions. And just remember this, at the core of a great innovative idea is a very specific customer need, and it's coded and supported with cold hard facts from the market information you're collecting. All right. The next principle I want to share with you is Nihito. Does anyone in this room know what that means? It's not Japanese. It's actually another acronym that stands for Nothing Important Happens in the Office. All right. So this is a little tongue-in-cheek, but what this means for innovation is that you're never going to discover your next big breakthrough by sitting behind your desk and running your organizations. To really discover innovative ideas, you have to get out from behind your desk, go out and interact with your customers, your organizations, listen and learn and discover the challenges you're faced with. All right? So congratulations, you're all practicing Nihito by being here today. So it's a good first step. And then as you go out, you now need to begin to aggregate and collect really good, concise customer feedback. And we at Vermeer, we call this our voice of customer. And this can take the shape of a lot of different things. Actually, tomorrow I've got a meeting for a planning of a new voice of customer. And it's usually a larger group that develops a list of 15 to 20 kind of common questions that you can go out and start to interview your customers to help uncover some of these needs and ideas. And it's really important to treat these voice of customer interviews and these trips different than a sales meeting. It's not a chance to try to sell a new product or to win a customer's relationship over. This is really an opportunity to listen, ask great open-ended questions, and really seek deep understanding of what it is that keeps them up at night, what are the challenges that they face. And as you start to do this over and over again, you start to see these common threads of issues that everyone's struggling with, and this is where your next big breakthrough is going to start to show its face. I like to use the metaphor almost like a crime scene, where you're treating this time very objectively, right? You're not applying any input. You're just trying to seek understanding, really trying to dig in and get to the core of the issue and the problem and trying to discover what it is that they're struggling with. But as you start to do this, you also need to be cautious, what I call the 80-20 rule, which oftentimes we go out and seek customer input. There's this noisy 20%, and you need to be cautious of the silent majority below the water. And you need to be asking yourself, is what I'm hearing representative of the whole market, or is this just what I'm hearing from a small slice, right? We don't want to pursue ideas or projects that are going to serve a small percentage of the market. And so one way to overcome this dilemma of voice of customer and the noisy 20% is to think about how you can diversify your voice of customer. Is there a way to send out a survey to perhaps reach some of those folks that aren't willing to give you the time? I don't know if many of you have those on perhaps some of your invoices where you're trying to seek feedback on how to do better or be better. But just think about different ways to uncover what could be some valuable information from the silent majority. Another great tool that we love to practice is win-loss interviews, especially after a loss sale. But I'll caution you, I'm sure your sales teams are really going to fight you on this. But if you can respectfully ask for a customer's time, 10 or 15 minutes, just to understand what it was your company was missing and how that you can do better the next time around, and really try to peel back the onion of what it was, what your product or your company was missing that caused them to lose the sale. It's also pretty valuable on a win, but it's usually reaffirming a lot of things that you're already doing, so there's not a lot of nuggets of information in there. But it could be reaffirming a new product idea, telling you that you're on the right track, you're going the right direction. But think about ways you can incorporate a win-loss interview within your sales teams. And so once you've got all these great ideas collected, now the challenge becomes, which ones do you tackle? Right? We all have limited resources. We can't solve all of our customers' problems. And we want to tackle the problems or the customer needs or the ideas that are going to make the biggest impact for our customers. And so at Vermeer, we have another lovely acronym where we filter these ideas through what we call the PUP filter. And these are ideas that are pervasively found, right? They're not onesie-twosies. It's not just for a few select customers. It's pervasively found throughout your entire customer base. The problem is urgently needed. So if you had it tomorrow, they'd be willing to buy. And then ultimately, they have to be willing to pay to solve the problem. And when you have a pool of all these great ideas and you're sitting down with your teams and trying to rank and prioritize all these different facets, it becomes very clear. Oftentimes, like for example, you could develop a new product, but if it's way more expensive to develop, chances are that customer is not willing to pay to solve that idea. And I think it's important too not to just throw these ideas out, but to keep them in the filter. And as you're continually developing new products, continually run these ideas back through this criteria, because oftentimes, you know, markets change, customer needs shift, perhaps a regulation will change, making it more urgent, or perhaps a technology will evolve, making it much more economical to develop. So once you've selected this great idea, the next key thing to do is to discover alignment. And this is where you do an honest assessment of what it is that you do really, really well that your competition might not. This is your competitive edge. And you really want to understand how well does this new idea fit or align with that, because you don't want to invest all the time and energy into this big breakthrough and then your competitor down the street just copies it and goes on with it. When we make these big investments, we want to protect them. This is also a point where you may discover or may want to ask the questions of, is there anything here that you can protect from an intellectual property standpoint, perhaps patented or at least a non-disclosure agreement if you've got other suppliers involved in the project. Keeping some secrecy to how things are done can be incredibly valuable, and it can pay dividends if you can protect the intellectual property around the development of this new idea. But perhaps, you know, through this process, you're very honest and you realize that, man, this is a big problem, but our company just can't do that very well. We don't have that competency. And this is just a really humble characteristic of a smart company that doesn't arrogantly think that they can be everything to all of their customers, right? This is a quick road to failure. But there are a couple paths here. If you realize that you are deficient in a particular competency to develop for your customers, you could either buy a competitor or a company that has that competency, or perhaps you could invest and buy in a technology that would allow you to deliver on that. The other key aspect of this is to partner with perhaps a competitor in a neighboring market or with another company that has that competency that could help you deliver on that project's needs. The third one here that I'll mention is there's another one of consultancy. Oftentimes there's specialized consultants that can come in and help uncover and discover and develop plans to improve a deficiency so you can have better alignment with those project needs. And then comes everyone's favorite topic of risk. And I don't really think it's a question of yes or no. It's really inherent in everything that we do. So it's rather a question of how much and how to overcome it. And this is truly where the rubber meets the road. This is where you get a gut check. Far too often, many of you will take the easier path, the lower risk path, and achieve mediocre success. But if you truly want a big breakthrough, you can't have it without the risks associated with it, right? So the good thing is that there's a couple different things that you can do to help manage and minimize the impact of the risk of failure within your projects. And so I want to talk about two different things. The first major risk factor is failure to understand your customer's needs. And so the first thing you can do to overcome this, as you're developing this new product, this new idea, validate it early and validate it often. And when possible, include customers, right? So at Vermeer, when we have a new product idea, we're working on, sometimes we call it a mule, where we're trying to develop some concepts of how this new machine might work. And then that product might evolve into a prototype, and we're doing a lot of internal testing. Once we have the confidence that this new product might work well, then we try to go out and get in front of customers and put it in real-world examples and seek customer feedback. And the reason why this is so valuable is as you're developing the project, there's lots of time and opportunity to tweak and make improvements. If you're not doing customer validation until you're out to market, it can be incredibly expensive and time-consuming to go back and make corrections to some of the blunders in that project. So validate and do it early and often. The next is to participate in groups and associations like you're doing here this week. Oftentimes, if you're not at the table, you can't listen and hear. Is this great new idea still relevant? Is something changing? Is it shifting? And if you're not participating in these industry groups, you could be missing something. All right. So participate and listen and learn and engage to validate whether or not this big idea, this big breakthrough, still carries the same impact. And then finally, understand the key market and policy drivers that will ultimately dictate how successful your project is. If something shifts, like a global pandemic, what consequence will that have on your new product? Or if a key regulation goes away, or if a new one comes in, what influence will that have on this new idea, this new product? Ignoring these and not understanding them can derail incredible projects and ideas in the final hour. And it can be incredibly expensive once you get through the full development project and something changes or shifts, can really be detrimental. So understand what those are, track, and try to manage them. The other key risk factor here is failure to create an effective solution. This one is under much more of your control. And I think it really starts with just good project management skills by naming the risk factors, ranking the severity of the impact, preparing your teams to overcome them, and then hopefully controlling that risk factor and overcoming it, and then hopefully eliminating it from your list of risks. And then on a routine basis, tracking the progress of those risk factors and asking the question of the relevancy and all of these different aspects here. At Vermeer, we're doing this on a weekly basis just because our teams are constantly working and evolving. We have a really tight thumb on all these different risk factors so we can control them much quicker. For you, it may be on a more monthly basis. It just depends on the scale and the velocity of a project. The second one is really the fear of failure. And as I've mentioned in the opening of this risk topic, is that really the enemy of innovation is the fear of failure. But I think it's really important. It's not a question of if you're going to fail, but it's a matter of when. Within our museum at Vermeer, we've got what we call the white elephant wall of all of our crazy ideas and big failures. And Gary Vermeer always said, if you're not failing 50% of the time, you're not trying hard enough. And the key here is to fail forward, which is really just learning from your failures. Once you experience a failure, it's great to do an analysis of what was the issue that failed. Was there a way to overcome it? And then how can you share that failure within your organization so it's not repeated time and time again? And then ultimately you need to decide, can we overcome this failure, make a correction, and keep the project moving? Sometimes a big failure is just the straw that broke the camel's back. So, and then ultimately, if you can't overcome the failure, you need to ask the question, go back to the discussion of alignment. Perhaps you were just a little over-optimistic on how competent you are within your organization, and you need to ask, are you honestly competent enough? Do you have the skill set to accomplish the needs of that project? If the answer is honestly no, and then there's still maybe opportunities to either buy or partner with another organization to help fulfill that project need. And then as you launch this new product, it's very natural. The development team hands it off to the production team, and guardrails get put up immediately, right? And this is important from an efficiency standpoint and a stability aspect. But just be cautious of how high and how rigid these guardrails are. At Vermeer, when we have a new product development, the development team is done and it hands it off to production. There's another special team called our enhancement team that is never done developing that new product idea. And we're constantly seeking and trying to understand the issues, the challenges. It's amazing when we develop this great new product, our customers find ways to end up breaking it or suggesting product improvements. And so think about what kind of guardrails are you putting up around your new product idea, because ultimately if they're too high, they're too stubborn, it's going to cause a new product idea to be stagnant and lose a lot of its inventiveness, right? A true innovative product is never done being iterated. All right, so in conclusion, how are you inspiring and empowering your organizations to think innovatively, and what are you doing to foster an innovative spirit within your organization to ultimately really harness the collective genius within your companies? And then are your new product ideas loosely formed opinions from the experts within your organization, or are they cold hard facts based on quality market information supported by that? And then how are you seeking customer input? What does that voice of customer look like for you? Do you have a systematic approach, or is it a very casual approach that many take? Once you have those great new ideas, how are you filtering out the ones to be the best for your organization? And how well do they align with your distinct competencies within your companies? And then finally, how are you managing risk and hopefully overcoming it to not letting it derail a project and ultimately lead you to a successful project? And I'm confident if you practice these principles and approaches time and time again, it will eventually lead you to your next big breakthrough, and it'll hopefully foster this industry into something great and brighter and better for the future. So with that, I want to thank you for your time, and I think we'll take a few questions if anyone's got any. As the questions may come in, I want to share with you some of the resources that I lean on. The one at the top, the Pragmatic Institute, is a great training resource. We use this at Vermeer to kind of create a common language across our organization when it comes to product development and product management. And it's a great resource. They have public courses where there's five different topics they unpack, and you can become a certified product manager through the Pragmatic Institute. And they've got a great magazine and lots of online resources. And then another great book that I really love is The Collective Genius, The Art and Practice of Leading Innovation by Linda Hill. She's a Harvard professor that looks at companies and what it is that they do to create that really strong, innovative spirit and culture within their organizations. And then finally, the last one I really like is Competing Against Luck by Clayton Christensen, who really changes the mindset around uncovering really innovative ideas and discovering those within your own market spaces. So, yes. Yeah, I honestly don't know. Being in the sales world, I don't know that we've vet really well through the innovation process how well they align with this. I'm not sure I've got a great answer to that question. Right. Yeah. I know some of the key characteristics of our engineers is we really like engineers that are hands-on. Obviously at our organization we get a wide range of engineers, but the engineers that aren't just comfortable sitting behind a desk but are willing to go out and get their hands on and are willing to wrench. So we love, you know, kids that have a farm background. If they've come from a farm, chances are they've done a lot of their own wrenching. And if they have the engineering background, It's a great match. I know some of our best engineers at Vermeer have a very mechanical background. Very good. Any other questions? Yes. Well, we try to listen to all of our customers, and you know, obviously we have our dealer network, who's a big customer of ours. But they all have different needs for different reasons. So it's, I guess, identifying what those different needs are, and are any of them aligned, and can we solve multiple problems with the same issue? Or what kind of example are you thinking about? Perhaps there's something in the more specific mulch world that you're talking about. Right. Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know if I've thought much about that. You know, so much of ours is customers like you who are buying our equipment to make the ultimate finished product for our customers. Great question. Any other questions? Yeah, I love the question of what it is that keeps you up at night. I think there's all these things in our lives and in our organizations that really just dog us. I think, you know, big problems around labor most likely. But I love that question. What is it that keeps you up at night? What is your biggest frustration that really holds your organization back? And if you had a magic wand to solve this one problem, what would that be? And usually it's a pretty lofty challenge, right? That's where those big breakthroughs lie, are in those areas where no one's developed a solution for that. In the back there? I don't know that we have a criteria. You know, when we go out with our voice of customer teams and this list of questions, we come back and really try to unpack what it is we've heard, what are a lot of the commonalities, and how can we boil it down into these buckets. And oftentimes, there are follow-up trips to revalidate some of those unexpected discoveries, and we're truly never done. I mean, we have the formal voice of customer events, but then as our sales teams are out, our engineering teams are out, they're constantly digging and trying to seek clearer understanding of that. So. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's the key. I think, like I alluded to in the description of this, so many of us, you know, because you've been successful businessmen, a lot of this is done intuitively just through conversations. But I think by formalizing the voice of customer, you can really uncover some of those core common threads and really start to see common problems across many of your customers instead of just casually, you know, uncovering these in discussion. So, yeah. Very good. Any other questions? If not, I thank you for your time and appreciate it.
All right, thank you all for your attention and questions during that session. I think one thing that's exciting about the topic that comes next after the break is we talked a little bit about customer focus. So our next